Bitcoiners, welcome back to another episode of FedWatch. I'm here with Ansel and a returning guest, all-star analyst from Bitcoin Magazine and the Deep Dive, Dylan LeClaire. What is up, my man? How you guys doing?
Doing great. Thanks for having me on again. Had a lot of fun the first time. I think that was back in April, maybe May. So, you know, quite a bit's changed, but quite a bit's also, you know, the same. So excited to chat again.
Yeah, I definitely hope we can have Dylan as a repeat guest because he's cranking out some good stuff for Bitcoin Magazine, and it's right up our alley here on FedWatch.
Yeah, well, yeah. Dylan, I guess, why don't you talk a little bit about what you're doing at the Deep Dive? Because you just dropped a hefty monthly report, and I think we're going to have you on pretty much on a monthly basis to kind of go through this with the FedWatch audience. But what's Deep Dive? What's in the monthly report? Why are you doing this product?
Yeah, so the Deep Dive is a Bitcoin Magazine premium financial market product that I kind of head off. So we do like macro stuff, Bitcoin on-chain analytics, and then derivative market analysis. And we kind of try to put it all together just to kind of give readers an inside look about what's happening, you know, under the hood, what to maybe expect. You know, it's not trading signals, but we are kind of showing why the markets kind of move the way they do and what like maybe certain imbalances that are building, and just to give people an edge if they want it. So trying to be fully transparent because we do have a lot of tools that the average person may not have. So yeah, that's the Deep Dive. I'm heading off that product and just released the August monthly report, which we're going to discuss today.
So before we get into the monthly report, today is September 7th, which is the big El Salvador Bitcoin day. It's a really exciting day, and it was definitely kind of a target for Bitcoin bulls, and Bitcoin price was pumping into the news. As we've seen many times, when there is kind of like big known news, that's often a sell the news type of an event or moment. So we've kind of experienced that again here. While we have both of you here, you know, would love to get both Ansel and Dylan's take on, you know, what we just experienced, maybe take us underneath the hood. Let's start with Dylan.
Yeah, I think basically what we just saw was a derivatives move. We have a lot of people that said they were going to, with what El Salvador is doing with their Chivo wallet, they said we're going to buy $30 of Bitcoin. And you had a bunch of Reddit users and Twitter users saying they were all going to do it at once. What I think most people don't understand is that Bitcoin is extremely liquid and at a market cap of like $900 billion. That spot demand, I mean, it does make a difference on the margin, but ultimately you had just a lot of people that were over leveraged long the derivatives market. And so that kind of unwound to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars. I think there was $800 million of liquidations over an hour or two. So, you know, it would have taken 20 million plebs to kind of counteract something like that, which is, you know, significant. And I don't think we had that. So that's kind of why we dumped, in my opinion. But I'm sure Ansel has, you know, opinion on this.
Yeah, exactly. I agree. I think it was a liquidation cascade, like we talked about just before we started recording. And I mean, there's all sorts of different ways that the plebs buying $30 can move the market, but they're not going out on spot exchanges most likely and buying $30. They're going in Cash App, they're going on Coinbase, they're going other routes to buy those things. And that Bitcoin that they're buying has already been bought weeks ahead of time, right? So these outlets or these retailers have supply to sell. And so, yeah, it's definitely a buy the rumor, sell the news event, like Christian said.
Is there anything else to say? Like people are saying manipulation or anything like that? Or is this just kind of how the market goes?
Yeah, I don't see anything about manipulation, Dylan.
Yeah, I mean, I think you have Bukele tweeting at the IMF, trolling them. I don't think it has anything, you know, I don't think there's any higher power here, so-called market manipulation. I think it's similar to what we've seen with Bitcoin a million times. You have derivative traders that are, you know, get too excited in one way or the other. And, you know, we kind of, something similar happened to a, you know, much bigger magnitude on May 19th when you had that big liquidation initially down to 30,000. The chart kind of looks similar when, like, when these events happen. It's not a steady grind down. A lot of people get just margin called at once. So I think that's it. No manipulation, just, you know, the free market at work.
I will add, I think there is room for manipulation in this event, but it wasn't on the markets. It was on those protests that we saw in El Salvador. That's not really in the scope of this discussion, but, you know, whenever you see large scale protests with these manufactured signs that are well put together and well designed and printed and all that, maybe there was some funding from outside sources.
Yeah, I mean, Dylan, I'll let you respond.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's people with a lot to lose with El Salvador adopting an open source monetary system, that's for sure. And the mainstream, the fiat chills are out and about today with Bitcoin debt.
So I think we're going to talk a lot more about what we think about the Bitcoin law, what we see happening moving forward. I'm all about those predictions, but the majority of this show is going to be kind of back looking onto what happened in August and like what to make of it from a like headline perspective. I guess it was a little slow. You know, there's a lot of hype about this event here in September. I want to dive into this report. So you kind of have it broken down into on-chain analytics, Bitcoin derivatives, hash rate, and then macroeconomic backdrop. Why don't you just start kind of like walking us through maybe one, how you structured this, and then maybe we can kind of dive into on-chain.
Yeah, so I structured it first kind of with a simple like overview of kind of what's happening, which is, you know, the adoption of this, the monetization process of this new form of money, and kind of breaking it down with like very simple supply and demand charts of what happens when there's an inelastic supply of a monetary asset, which is something we've never seen. And so when demand rises, you know, simple supply and demand, then price can only do one thing. And, you know, like in a big picture, that's what Bitcoin's been doing for the last 10 years. You could go in a coma and come back and Bitcoin's price has risen because fundamentally supply, the terminal inflation rate of Bitcoin is zero and demand continues to rise. Without any metrics or anything else, that's what's happening and the network effect behind that. I kind of started with that and then went to more of on-chain. Actually, because Bitcoin is this transparent ledger, you can actually see this kind of big demand increase occurring. And you can see these massive accumulation trends, which have more or less been, there was a big structural shift back in March of 2020 after kind of like the COVID crisis with supply and demand dynamics. That trend has basically held steady. And so we saw kind of like a deviation of that in May, but really it's just millions of coins. Now about 14 million Bitcoin are illiquid and more becoming illiquid every day, meaning essentially accumulation by strong-handed Bitcoiners who are reducing this free float. And so that was kind of the focus of the report and on-chain. And then I kind of blended it with what's happening with the macro backdrop, which is more or less driving the actual accumulation trend, which is unprecedented monetary and fiscal policy and central bank kind of monetization. So do you want to dig into anything in specific or do you want me to just kind of continue to rip?
No, I really like this Bitcoin supply by liquidity cohort chart. I think that that's really interesting because I don't think most people realize how significant the illiquid supply is compared to what is liquid / highly liquid.
Yeah. So, you know, the circulating supply is about 18.8 million. Basically over time, the trend of illiquid supply is up and to the right. So day to day, you know, you'll have big market players that buy or sell thousands or tens of thousands of Bitcoin. But basically, there's about 3 million highly liquid and 1 million liquid Bitcoin. And so that when you kind of see these big moves, and some of the times they're exacerbated by derivative markets, but it's really kind of the same like 3 to 4 million Bitcoin that are kind of being wash traded around. But you have a pleb army, the auto DCA army, an increasing amount of people around the world that are continuing to buy and hold sats every single day. And so that is just kind of, you know, there's just the free float is continuing to basically be eroded away, which over time creates this supply squeeze. The volatility aside, that's the trend, kind of just framing it as this illiquid supply is continuing to grow over time with deviations from the trend, like in May when 100,000 plus Bitcoin went back into the liquid supply. But yeah, the trend is clear, and that's kind of what's driving all of this.
Yeah, I think my favorite chart here is the Bitcoin HODLer net position change for 30 days. And it fluctuates between green and red with the price chart in the background. And man, it's really spiked recently. Can you talk about this chart?
Yeah, so this is pretty interesting. The HODLer net position change, basically with the transparent ledger and the Bitcoin UTXO set, there's this metric called coin days destroyed. So say there's 1,000 Bitcoin that are held for one day, there's 1,000 coin days that are created. Also, if say one Bitcoin is held for 1,000 days, 1,000 coin days are also created. And so when those coins are moved, those so-called coin days are destroyed. And so using this data, you can actually see, you can map out trends between, you know, like hodler position changes and what's actually happening. And so kind of during this run-up late in 2020, we saw a lot of like hodlers kind of cash out, right? Like these guys have been hodling for thousands of percent gains. And it's kind of, it makes sense to take some chips off the table as there's this massive capital influx, right? There has to be someone on the other side of the trade. And as all this new money's coming in, some people are cashing out. And what you actually saw was basically after the May crash and a 50% reduction, the hodler net position change started to creep back up again. So you saw this net accumulation happen again. Whereas like hodler net position change is calculated a little bit different than the e-liquid supply metrics, which are calculated basically on whether a UTXO entity, which with on-chain analytics and heuristics basically tells if an output's ever been spent. But this hodler net position change is really, really useful when looking at, you know, the 10-year history of Bitcoin, because it's also pretty clear what's happening, which is hodlers are accumulating. And so, you know, you can kind of think of this as the smart money and following 50% reduction. And most recently, while Bitcoin is pumping, hodler net position changes is spiking really hard. And so that's telling, in my opinion.
Yeah, it would be nice to see it go back further. I would like to see it during 2019 and 2020 with the Corona crash in March of last year, because I've been watching this recently, the similarity between 2020 and 2021, where we had the Corona crash in March and now we have this crash now, is, I think, kind of similar to that Corona crash. And if that's the case, then, you know, the upside is still to come in this cycle. But I mean, there's a lot of different similarities. So in 2019, we saw the run up, and then we saw a slow bear market that ended with the Corona crash. And then we saw the run up again. And now we've seen kind of a slow bear market for the last couple months that's maybe ending with this crash here, the El Salvador crash, and then it'll be up for the next leg. What do you think of that kind of cycle kind of playing out?
Yeah, I kind of agree that, you know, we saw just kind of a mini bear market. And where I agree with this, you know, 50% pullback from 64K in April to you know, as low as like 29,000 in May or June even, was that, you know, there was a lot of spot selling, but the later stages of that kind of, and during the bottom, derivative market traders continued to stay bearish for far longer than the actual spot traders, and the spot accumulation was taking place. And so eventually it kind of led to this pretty big short squeeze, whereas, you know, you see funding was negative for far longer, kind of suppressing that price, like when we were at 9,000 for months on end last summer. It was kind of similar to when we were trading up in the 30,000 range, and we saw, you know, a pretty big squeeze to 40K. And, you know, I highlighted this in one of the daily dives, but you saw the Binance perpetual swap, which is actually the most traded derivative contract on the planet, touched 48,000 because you had so many people that were offsides short. And so you'll see this happen in Bitcoin, where you have the spot market and you have the derivative market. And most of the time, just derivative traders are bullish. I mean, it's hard to not be bullish on the most bullish, the best performing asset of all time. And so there naturally is a net demand to be long. But sometimes you see these opportunities, like following the COVID crash, and just recently about a month ago, where the derivative market is short and everyone else is accumulating.
All right, Bitcoiners, I want to tell you about our newest sponsor. This show is brought to you by Ledin.io. I have been super, super impressed with the guys over at Ledin. I've actually known the co-founders, Adam and Maurizio, for a very long time. I've had the pleasure to watch them build Ledin up from a tiny, tiny startup to now a super impressive institutional grade Bitcoin and crypto lender. Y'all, I'm so impressed with these guys. They are offering some of the best rates out there. I don't think anyone even comes close to touching them. You can get 6.1% APY on your first two Bitcoin that you deposit into Ledin interest accounts, and you can get 8.5% on USDC deposits. I mean, I know all the competitors. They're not even close. If you're going to put your crypto and your Bitcoin into an interest account, Ledin is by far the best. And on top of that, like I said, these guys are hardcore Bitcoiners, and they know the products and the services that Bitcoiners want and appreciate. They came up with B2X
It allows you to put your Bitcoin in, they leverage it up, and you can, with one click of the mouse, get twice the exposure to Bitcoin. So if you're super bullish, Ledin has you covered with a super, super easy way to get leverage with B2X. And then on top of that, they know that Bitcoiners care about your reserves. They know that Bitcoiners don't like under-reserved and not full-reserved financial institutions. So they are pushing the frontier in transparency in the digital asset lending space. And they are the first digital asset lender to do a full proof of reserves and proof of attestation through a Mariano LLC, a public accounting firm. So the Ledin guys, they know what Bitcoin is like. They are legit. I encourage you guys to check them out. Do your own research and go to ledin.io. That is ledin.io and learn more. Bitcoiners, I want to tell you about The Deep Dive. The Deep Dive is Bitcoin Magazine's premium market intelligence newsletter. This is a no-fluff, hard-hitting, incredible newsletter going deep into the market, helping you understand what's happening with derivatives, what's happening on-chain, what's happening in macro, what's happening with the narrative, and what's happening with the tech. My man, Dylan LeClaire, is an absolute savant. He is making his name known in the Bitcoin community, getting shout-outs left and right, getting on podcasts left and right, and him and his team are bringing you everything that you need to know about Bitcoin. You don't even have to be on Bitcoin Twitter. You can ignore every other newsletter. This is the newsletter to rule them all. Go over to members.bitcoinmagazine.com, sign up today. And if you use promo code MACRO, you get a full month for free. You have nothing to lose. What are you waiting for? Sign up, see the incredible work that Dylan and his team are putting out. And if you don't like it, just unsubscribe. You don't pay a dime. But if you do, you know, it's going to be well worth the sats in investment in understanding Bitcoin and gaining the confidence to continue to invest in Bitcoin and making the right moves around Bitcoin. And it's going to be well worth every single Satoshi. Again, can't recommend it enough. That is members.bitcoinmagazine.com, promo code MACRO. Do it today.
I'd also like to get your take on GBTC and the premium. I didn't notice this in the August report because it really hasn't been an issue probably since June or July. But what's your take on, so the run-up end of 2020, you know, was characterized by a pretty significant GBTC premium that forced Grayscale to go out and buy Bitcoin. And now at a discount, they don't have that incentive anymore. Today, the discount actually was cut in half from like 20% to 10%. And I think that could possibly turn positive. Do you have a take on the GBTC, the discount, and its effect on price over the last couple months?
Yeah, I mean, I think GBTC was kind of one of those, not black swans, like white swans, where Grayscale bought 200,000 Bitcoin because of how far that product traded above its net asset value. So you had basically a bunch of funds that were pummeling cash into this product to capture like a risk-free quote-unquote trade. And as that unwound because of the six-month lockup in that trust, they went negative. And I think that was one of the things that kind of, it just kind of made the bear market or that 50% pullback we saw a little worse than expected, because you had basically this Bitcoin-like product that was trading at minus 20% to its net asset value. So I think for a time being, and even maybe today a little bit, if it's trading at minus 10% to net asset value, it's stealing a little bit of the spot demand, because you have funds like ARK and you have a lot of asset managers that, instead of going through CME, which is a paper derivative market, or just, you know, going through the hassle of actually buying spot with a lot of these custodians, they can just go buy GBTC shares, and that's fine with them. And, you know, they're fine with the fee because maybe it's just rather swing trade. So I do think that had some effect when we were kind of at the bottom there, the 30,000 range. But I think, you know, the GBTC premium or rather discount is going to kind of normalize around, you know, that 5-6% range as the market kind of prices that in, and the fees or maybe the probability of an ETF in. And, you know, if it turns back positive, that's really bullish in my opinion, because, you know, one of the biggest buyers during this run-up that we saw at the end of 2020 would return.
I want to move over and start talking about hash rate, because I think over the summer, hash rate was just falling. China was having this mining exodus. A lot of speculation is this an attack. People don't like unaccounted for hash rate to kind of just be lying around the planet. And we have pretty much seen a steady increase in hash rate, and a lot of the hash rate kind of going into the month, or I guess previous before the drop, is returning. So can you kind of give us the breakdown on what's happening in the Bitcoin mining world from a just hash rate perspective?
Yeah, so really bullish, actually. And hash rate has come back online faster than I had expected it to. I think some of it has to do with that there was just a backlog in general because of the COVID supply chains and all that. So there was a pretty big backlog in terms of, you know, ASIC deliveries that people ordered back in 20, you know, these operations ordered back in 2020. I still think there's a lot of rigs that are looking for a home. There's almost no hosting facilities available. And so, you know, that takes time to kind of build all that out and set it up. And just from what I've heard kind of anecdotally, there are a lot of mining rigs that are just still kind of locked away in storage looking for a home. But the, you know, this kind of aggressive bounce back we saw, you know, late July and all of August, where we've seen three straight positive difficulty adjustments, that's really bullish. And it's, you know, I think it's recovering faster than I thought. And, you know, there's a pretty big headwind there for mining operations and kind of, and their profit margins with this, you know, aggressive bounce back. I mean, the North American mining industry in particular made out great following that move from China over the summer.
What's your take on the chip shortage? You think that's still, I mean, I've heard recently that it could get worse again before it gets better, even this chip shortage. So do you see that weighing on the hash rate still? Or is this just a matter of, like you said, moving jurisdictions and finding the shelf space, et cetera, for mining equipment?
Yeah, I think the global semiconductor shortage is something that definitely is, you know, has an effect on the ASIC production. There aren't many Bitcoin mining manufacturers out there, and actually most of them are in the West, or in the East, I'm sorry. So seeing things like what was announced last month with Blockstream and that how they're going to create their own ASIC, that's very bullish, and that's something that's going to take some time. But having an ASIC manufacturer on North American soil is really big. But, you know, just structurally, you know, you see anything that with a semiconductor has shot up in price over the last year just because of these supply chain shortages. A lot of this stuff is extremely complex build. So like things like used cars, for example, are skyrocketing because of this semiconductor shortage. And I think Bitcoin miners are no different. They kind of trade as like a derivative. These ASICs trade as like a derivative to Bitcoin itself. And actually, you know, with this big fall in hash rate, even though there has been a recovery, it's similar levels to where it was in late 2020 when Bitcoin was trading around 9, 10, 11, 12,000. And so now at $40,000, $50,000 Bitcoin, these miner profit margins are extremely large, and they actually don't have to sell, which is leading to some of this kind of upwards pressure on the market.
Yeah, one of my favorite indicators is the hash rate ribbon, or the hash ribbon. And you have a chart of that in your monthly report. Christian, can you share your screen and bring that up? Can you go through this? I mean, I write about it in my newsletters, but for people that are unfamiliar, can you step us through maybe some of the vertical shading that you have here?
Yeah, so the hash ribbons is essentially just takes the 60-day and 30-day moving average of hash rate. It shows when miner capitulation is occurring. So when the 30-day moving average of hash rate goes below the 60-day moving average, it's signaling that miners are unplugging, and that essentially there's capitulation occurring. And what we've seen throughout the history of Bitcoin is that when this happens, there's usually it's either neutral to bearish in terms of price action, because they're basically the producers of Bitcoin are under stress. They may have to fire sale some of their treasury onto the market. Specifically in this case, it wasn't really a natural market-driven phenomenon, but rather a political phenomenon where a lot of these operations had to move overnight and it was unexpected. So that definitely played a part in the sell-off. But now you kind of see hash rate recovering really fast. Miner profit margins are wide as ever. And so you saw the 30-day moving average of hash rate cross back over above the 60-day moving average. And so this indicator, while maybe it's different circumstances than usual, still very bullish in my opinion, as, you know, Bitcoin is a very momentum-driven asset. And during, you know, up cycles, the price trend can be pretty reflexive, especially when miners are profitable and don't have to sell. And now with mining increasingly becoming kind of these operations having access to public markets and like the capital that comes with that, you have operations like Hut 8 who don't sell any of their mined Bitcoin and actually just use leverage in the public markets to cover their expenses.
Yeah, I think this chart is great. There's a couple things here like that I wanted to pull out from what you said. The unexpected nature is very important, because if you look at this chart, that we have on YouTube, guys. If you're just listening to the audio version, go and watch us on the Bitcoin Magazine YouTube channel, and you'll see the chart we're talking about. But there is a pullback in the hash rate around October, November of 2020. That's typical at that time of year because of the wet season, right? That's the end of the wet season, end of the dry season for China. And so that was expected. And then if you look at the price was not affected, right? So the hash rate dipped there, but the price wasn't affected because of it being expected. But at other times when price dips or when hash rate is pulling back because of unexpected things, like you said, that's definitely when you see more of a bearish price movement. Do you have anything to add to that?
Oh, I completely agree. You know, just like the best examples of hash ribbons and was at the end of kind of 2018 when you saw following that big retracement from 20K, Bitcoin kind of flatlined at 6K and it looked like that was the bottom. And then you saw hash rate decline while we were at 6K, like pretty significantly. And then it was almost vertical down to 3,000. And that was one of the biggest like minor capitulation events Bitcoin has ever seen. And so that's just kind of an example of like what hash ribbons is kind of showing you. It takes kind of, there's a lot of meat in this metric, even though it's quite simple, just two moving averages. But hash rate is very telling. And when hash rate is declining quite significantly, that's usually pretty bearish.
So Dylan, in terms of like, let's talk about what's happening with the futures markets and things like that. I think we jumped over that, but we don't actually have to look at the chart. I'm just kind of curious in terms of like what the futures markets look like moving forward and how they played out this past month. Like, how does that diverge from the spot market? You know, you kind of mentioned that they can be different. Can you just talk about what it was and then how you like see that playing out post this dump here?
Yeah, I mean, the futures markets, honestly, it looks pretty solid. I mean, what we saw in early 2020 while Bitcoin was going parabolic, basically straight to 60,000 was like there was a huge bid. And so essentially like the December futures contract, December 2021, I think at one point touched near $90,000. And so what that meant was there was basically this risk-free arbitrage where people could go in and be market neutral and make like 40, 50% annualized returns by selling the futures and shorting spot. And there was a huge kind of speculative frenzy to that market as everyone thought Bitcoin was straight to 100,000 and that pullbacks and leverage kind of mattering were a thing of the past. And so now, you know, we seem to be in a much more kind of a market neutral place where these annualized futures yields, the basis, some people like to call it contango, which was, you know, that was talked about a lot earlier in the year. That's really settled down, which is good to see. It kind of shows that this is much more of like an intrinsic value, if you want to call that. I don't like using intrinsic value, but you know, this is more like the spot market is driving this recent recovery from the lows. And so I think that's really promising. And you can also look at things like funding rate, where the high funding was actually what led to this little mini 10-15% crash that we saw today, that flash crash. But when you saw earlier in the year, as in April, as we were at that 60K level, funding was high and sustained high for long periods of time, specifically people using Bitcoin to long Bitcoin, BTC margin, coin margin contracts were an increasingly large percent of the derivative market. And so things like that are kind of what you see near tops. And for the most part, we're not seeing that at all, which is really good. Funding's moderately positive, which means, you know, traders are bullish, which is natural for the best performing asset of all time. But it's nothing that's too worrying than that we're, you know, kind of topping or any sort of speculative mania occurring.
Yeah, I mean, the bull is definitely still young as far as I'm concerned, and there's a lot more to go. Like, let's zoom out now to like the macro backdrop, which is a pretty hefty part of the report. And I think this is where the show gets a little interesting because this is maybe where Ansel and Dylan kind of diverge with what they're seeing. But let's jump into, I guess you start off with the CPI.
Yeah, so it's kind of funny because in past reports, I've said that looking at CPI and trying to determine what the Bitcoin price action is going to do is not really the best way to look at things because, one, we're talking about consumer price inflation and not monetary base or asset inflation. But these basically decade high year-over-year CPI readings are pretty significant, especially when it comes to things like credit markets and equities and, you know, just the more the legacy financial system more broadly. So I kind of brought it from there. I brought it to real yields, or actually I just used the 10-year treasury and then the TIPS yield, which is the inflation protected securities. And, you know, these are trading basically near kind of their decade long lows. The 10-year is at 1.29% and the treasury inflation protected securities negative. It's basically highlighting just more broadly that we're kind of in the same sort of macro position where rates are lower for longer. Rates have to kind of remain in real terms negative to kind of keep the system glued together. And that's the Fed and really central banks globally are kind of forced to be in this position. They don't really have a choice. And so, yeah, I think that's kind of where we see a growing role for Bitcoin as this neutral reserve asset that has no yield, but also there's no counterparty risk or dilution risk.
Yeah, I don't have much to add to that. I mean, yes, CPI year over year is doing what it's doing, but I'll just point out on that CPI chart, if you scroll up there, Christian, the last time we were this high, what happened next? Yeah. You know what I mean? So it's an imperfect measure. It's hard to draw conclusions from it, but it's definitely saying that, like we've, Christian and I have been saying on this show for a while, is that there is this fragility in the market. You know, there feels like something big is coming, and whether that's another Lehman type moment, we saw this just today or yesterday in China with Evergrande, their big retail real estate empire that they have over there. Their bonds are pretty much worthless at this point. The trading has stopped on them. And maybe that's a global Lehman moment again, just like we saw back last time the CPI was around this level. So, but yeah, I think it's very good in this report that you guys are mentioning these types of macro backdrops, even though it's hard to piece together cause and effect or anything like that. But understanding where Bitcoin fits in the grand scheme of things, I think, is very important.
I think there's some merit to mentioning that when CPI kind of rips like this, a lot of people are saying like inflation is transitory. I think there is a good chance that CPI inflation there might continue to rip higher with these supply chain shortages, but the year over year, like the second derivative of inflation, very well could be transitory. But if you're talking about just not the derivative of inflation, but actual prices across the board, when you have these supply chain dislocations and disruptions, I don't think prices aren't going to deflate back to where they were, even though the year over year metric could go to that zero bound again.
I definitely think it's worth talking about inflation versus deflation. I'm sure we'll get into it more, but I just found this chart to be, again, like such a powerful chart in terms of what the Fed holds in terms of treasury. So do you want to break down what we're looking at here and what this means?
Yeah, so I just kind of found it interesting while I was doing my research that when you're looking at things like everybody's been talking about the reverse repo operations where there's, you know, $1 trillion in this facility. And while I didn't take a deep dive into that during the report, it's all kind of interconnected. And it's basically people, there's nowhere to kind of, there's so much liquidity going around and there's not many places to park that. And so when things like the inflation protected treasury are, you know, they haven't carry a negative yield. And part of the reason they do is because, especially right after COVID, the Fed actually, I think they ended up buying more TIPS than were actually issued. And so the Fed's holdings of these securities increased from around 8% to 22% of the total outstanding supply. And so they were a huge buyer, and it kind of shows you their impact on this market.
Bitcoiners, I am so excited to tell you about the Bitcoin 2022 conference. You guys, Bitcoin 2021 was absolutely a smash hit success. It was over 13,000 Bitcoiners coming together, breaking the barriers on who can come together and celebrate freedom, celebrate Bitcoin, and the energy was absolutely electric. Unfortunately, it was just oversubscribed. There's just people flowing out everywhere. And this year, we are learning. We are making the conference bigger and better. We are moving over to the Miami Beach Convention Center, and we are going to be throwing a massive 4-day festival for Bitcoin, celebrating Bitcoin, bringing together the greatest minds in Bitcoin and the greatest businesses in Bitcoin. And lastly, the culture of Bitcoin all together. We have a 4-day extravaganza planned for you guys for Bitcoin 2022. Day one is going to be industry day. It is a day where you can buy a special ticket in order to just mingle and make business deals happen. Day two and three is going to be a full-blown Bitcoin conference. This is our main conference. This is going to be on April 7th and 8th. And then lastly, we have the Sound Music Festival day four. Imagine going to Coachella, but for Bitcoin. There's going to be very few talks. It's going to be all about the culture of Bitcoin. It's going to be all about hanging with your fellow plebs. And it's going to be an absolutely amazing time. There's going to be Bitcoin musicians, Bitcoin artists, and all your favorite Bitcoiners, and just an amazing environment to party and just see it all, soak it all in, and to get people to realize that a Bitcoin world, a world filled with Bitcoin people doing Bitcoin things, is the world that they want to live in. That's what Bitcoin 2022 is all about. That is what the Bitcoin conference is all about. That's what Bitcoin Magazine is all about. So it is going to be a celebration of Bitcoin, the Bitcoiners, and this amazing movement that is going to make the world a better place. Go to b.tc/conference. Learn more about the Bitcoin conference. Learn more about all the amazing things that are happening in Miami around the Bitcoin conference, and buy your tickets. And guess what? If you buy your tickets with Bitcoin, you save $100 on all the tickets and $1,000 on the whale pass. So if you want the VIP pass, the big kahuna, if you buy with Bitcoin, you save $1,000. That's a lot of sats. So go and do it right now today. Don't wait. Prices are only going up. This is going to be a can't miss event. Bitcoiners, let's take a break from the content. And I want to tell you about Coolbix. Coolbix is an awesome Bitcoin hardware wallet that's been around for a really long time. They are building an amazing Bitcoin wallet called the Cool Wallet Pro. The Cool Wallet Pro is state of the art Bitcoin hardware wallet technology. Its form factor is like a credit card. You can put it into your wallet, and it is designed to go with you on the go. So that way, even when you're on the go, you can have the benefit of a two-factor hardware wallet design when you're trying to spend your Bitcoin. So you can have your Bitcoin wallet UX on your phone and make it really easy to scan, decide what you want to do, but then you sign with a Coolbit X, which is in your back pocket. It is tamper proof. It is waterproof. It is flexible. It has an awesome secure element in it. And it is a really awesome way in order to have some more flexibility, yet security when you're taking your Bitcoin on the go. I personally am a fan of this idea of making Bitcoin into a medium of exchange and making it into something that people use. I know it's going to take time, but they are working on the UX for making that possible in as secure a way possible. So have some peace of mind. Check out the Cool Wallet Pro from Coolbix, and thank you to them for sponsoring this podcast.
What else you got, Christian? Next one?
Well, I mean, I think I would like to talk about this idea of asset inflation, the Thrifin's dilemma. These are all kind of subjects that, let's just say, there's the central banker perspective on it. Then there's like the mainstream opposition to the central banker perspective. And then there's more of a fringe perspective, you know, how this all plays together. But like, what's your take on just like this idea of asset inflation? I personally have been listening to a lot of Michael Saylor recently. I re-listened to the Saylor series with Breedlove. He talks about every asset and every person kind of needs their own inflation rate. You can't have one CPI for everyone. Like everyone has their own basket of goods they care about and different framings on how to think about inflation. But again, it's a nuanced and complex topic.
Yeah, I think in the report I said asset inflation as a matter of national security. And the US is in a really interesting position as like the world reserve currency, because what you see with balance of trade and, you know, with countries running deficits, there's a self-correcting mechanism to this, where back when countries traded with gold, their currencies were backed by gold. If you had a big balance of payments deficit, your currency would weaken, and that balance of payments would actually self-correct because your currency got weaker and your exports actually would become more attractive. But because we're the world reserve currency and there's this artificial, if you want to call it, bid in the market, what you see is that this actually never really corrects. The US has seen their like our domestic manufacturing get hollowed out over the course of the last 50 years, but really the last 20 years in particular, and certain industries stand to benefit, like the financial system, where all of these nations continue to basically recycle their treasuries and all of their excess dollars back into our financial markets. So DC, Wall Street, these sectors, the coasts, they do really, really well, while middle America and the average person, maybe your average worker, manufacturer, or whatnot, actually gets hit really, really hard. And so these are big ideas. And I'm not saying that Bitcoin fixes this overnight, but structurally, the position that the United States is in is very unique, and it's not comparable to just the average nation, because we are this world reserve currency and we are kind of stuck in this system. And really, the only way out is to devalue, to continue to debase.
Yeah, that was going to be my question there that you hit right on the end, was where is this going? Because I do agree that, I disagree with some of the stuff on Triffin, but I do agree that, like we just covered, that there's some moment coming. And so what does this trade deficit, current account stuff, what does that tell you about what the future looks like? Let's go like 10 years in the future. Trade deficits eventually will have to equalize, right? So what does that mean for U.S. living standards? What does that mean for other living standards around the world that really want to export their goods to the United States? Well, now if we don't have a trade deficit, they're not going to be able to do that. So what does that look like? And maybe try to tie in Bitcoin if you can.
Yeah, I'm kind of in the Luke Gromen camp, where Luke always talks about, Luke's a great macroeconomist, he talks about how weakening the dollar strategically is something that's advantageous, because it would allow us to kind of reshore a lot of our domestic manufacturing and things like that, where over 2020 with COVID, we kind of realized there was a moment where the US realized that we're dependent on really our geopolitical competitors for everything that we need, from pharmaceuticals to semiconductors to all of these things, because of the structural elements of the Trifon dilemma and the world reserve currency. Robert Trifon was an economist who basically predicted that these problems would happen in the 1950s or the 1960s. He predicted this would happen with a world reserve currency. And so little did he know that, you know, it would happen exactly as he said, and we would end up breaking the gold standard, and the system would last for another 70 years, or I'm sorry, another 50 years. But his kind of recommendation was this neutral reserve asset. And so while that would have been the bank, or we now have this neutral reserve asset energy currency, which is increasingly more on an individual level being used for global trade. And so I think from the US perspective, it would be attractive to continue to kind of, I guess, print money in an effort to reshore a lot of our strategically important things that we don't have, which are, you know, chip foundries, things that, you know, we don't have onshore that we used to. We want to kind of remain this global competitive superpower. And I think that devaluing competitively, even more so relative to other nations, is something that is actually attractive. And eventually, you see some people talking about the U.S., and during the recent kind of bill and all of that, that just went down with proof of work mining and the crypto regulations, the White House actually came out in favor of proof of work over proof of stake for a period of time. Some kind of had a thesis that there was people behind the scenes that kind of understand the game that's being played and are pushing for kind of adoption of Bitcoin. So I don't really have too much insight on that, but I think it's an interesting idea. And I think that from a game theoretic perspective, Bitcoin adoption is a must. And so that's something that, you know, I hope we see, but I'm cautiously optimistic.
I feel like a lot of kind of back and forth between the people who don't necessarily believe the Fed are more just definitional. And I'm just kind of curious to, like, you know, deflation, inflation, all this kind of stuff. What's the best way to kind of define what's happening? Because the way that I would kind of summarize it is, like, the money doesn't work. The money is manipulated. It's not transparent. Even the people who control it, quote unquote, don't really know all the aspects of it. And, you know, hence why they're so reactive. I mean, there's a lot of objective data to show that they're just completely reactive and not proactive with controlling the economy, right? So, I mean, I don't even like to stick a specific brand to it. I just say, like, there's too much baloney here. I know that, you know, again, there's a lot of squabbling around, like, you know, what did Robert Trifon actually mean? Did he actually predict all that kind of stuff? Is that the right context? I'm kind of curious what you guys think. I want to go to Ansel first.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. It doesn't necessarily matter if we call it inflation or deflation, but the money doesn't work. It's like pushing on a string. Okay, there's too much debt in the world. And you can't get yourself out of a debt problem by adding more debt, right? And my view is that eventually there is a credit collapse or of some sort. Like, right now, the most they can do is just keep it afloat, right? They can keep this bubble propped up, but eventually there's going to be a credit collapse. And that to me is deflationary. That's why I talk about deflation the most versus inflation. It also can, like, we, who did we have on that we were talking about this? Jeff Booth and Aaron Segal, I think, or Siegel. And we were talking about why is it important to say inflation and deflation? And yeah, I think it is important in a way because it informs your decision-making process in the market. So either way, Bitcoin is a hedge against inflation or deflation. Same with gold. It used to be a hedge against inflation or deflation because of its money. It's sound money. So that's all I have to say about that. What do you got, Dylan?
Yeah, I agree with you in the sense that people's characterization of what's happening is sometimes misdefined, where the money printer go burr meme is, it's a good meme or narrative, but like quantitative easing, actual credit expansion, it feels inflationary because the present value of assets is rising when rates are low. But in the reality, in a fiat monetary system, a dollar is created through credit. And so that dollar has to be repaid back in the future plus with interest. So the very nature of debt is that it's deflationary eventually. And so they've continued to kind of kick the can, but yeah, eventually the debt has to be repaid and more debt can't fix a debt problem. And so, you know, we've continued to see debt to GDP, total debt to GDP continue to go higher and higher and higher. And eventually that can't sustain itself. And so I ended their report with saying Ludwig van Mises' quote. He says, there is no means of avoiding the final collapse of a boom brought about by credit expansion. The alternative is only whether the crisis should come sooner as a result of voluntary abandonment of further credit expansion or later as a final and total catastrophe of the currency system involved. And so I think kind of, unfortunately, you know, it's going to be one of those two, but I think policymakers and the political incentives are that we're going to continue to push so hard that there is some ultimate kind of form of collapse. I don't, you know, I think there is going to be some unwind, but I'm cautious about whether they actually let it unwind. Maybe the rules, the Fed charter has changed or something of that nature. But the reality is that we're trapped in this deflationary outcome where there's so much debt. Technological deflation is pushing down as well, demographics. And so the debt can't be repaid. And so ultimately creditors are either going to not get paid or they're going to get paid and what they're paid with is going to be worthless. That's essentially, besides the technological lens, the thesis for Bitcoin is it's one of the only things that you're 100% sure of you're going to own when this kind of monetary reset that I think we're living through when we're at the end of the tunnel.
I feel like that's a pretty banging spot to wrap it up, but there is one more chart in the report and is right before your Ludwig van Mises quote, and that's the Bitcoin energy value chart. I'm going to share it really quick. I want you to talk about this because, again, I feel like Bitcoin is both a radical and a not so radical solution to kind of like this global monetary problem. And I just think that, you know, a lot of people who may or may not know that much about Bitcoin, they're unsure about like the energy usage thing when truly it is at the core of what actually makes Bitcoin such a revolution. So can you talk about this chart?
Yeah. Bitcoin energy value. It was created by Charles Edwards from Capriol Investments. He's actually the same guy who thought of or proposed that the hash ribbons indicator. He puts up some great work and research, but hash ribbons is essentially, it just takes hash rate with some other variables and inputs. And in terms of like the average miner energy costs or like, you know, per kilowatt hour and ASIC efficiency and all this stuff, and basically comes up with more or less like the production cost of Bitcoin. And so, you know, there's so many different ways to think of Bitcoin. Is it a currency? Is it an asset? But I think Bitcoin is partly is a commodity in the sense that there is a production cost. And although there is 21 million and there is no inflation, Bitcoin is being produced every single day. And so with hash rate and with all the things like the difficulty adjustment, there is a distinct production cost. And the kind of incentive or the mechanism behind Bitcoin's monetization process is as the price rises, the profit incentive of Bitcoin mining rises, which brings on additional hash rate, which increases the difficulty, which makes kind of producing Bitcoin that much more energy intensive. So the Bitcoin energy value is perpetually rising. And it's kind of baked into the incentive structure of the protocol. And so I like to think of Bitcoin as kind of a commodity, as this monetary commodity similar to gold, right? What gives gold its value is that, among many things, all of its monetary attributes is the kind of the unforgeable costliness behind gold. No matter what happens, there's going to be a distinct production cost to go dig up some more gold. And that's kind of how you think of Bitcoin. And so we saw that energy value, that production cost of Bitcoin tank with the hash rate falling off. But Bitcoin is this, you know, this perfectly engineered kind of machine and keeps on ticking. And with the last three difficulty adjustments and the price ticking back up, we're seeing that energy value tick back up as well. With hash rate, I think this energy value is going to pump forever. Something that I like to look at when evaluating the ecosystem and also things like Bitcoin mining stocks and other things as an investment.
Awesome. Well, Dylan, thank you so much for coming on to the show. Again, I think that we're going to bring you back on a lot more to do this kind of monthly review. I thought that this was extremely enlightening, like diving into a lot of these charts. So thanks again. Why don't you give a second to show what you're doing again, tell people where they can find you.
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at @DylanLeClaire_. I do the deep dive product for Bitcoin Magazine. And you can, I don't know if you are going to have a like promotion at the front, but you can use discount code BITS, I believe, for 1 month off. But try it out and, you know, see what it's all about before giving a paid sub. But yeah, I really appreciate you guys having me on. And it was awesome to talk with you and Ansel.
Yeah, man. Always a good time. Ansel, what's your last words?
Oh, that's it. Dylan, thanks for coming on. Yeah, this is a great product and hope to maybe dive down in one topic a little bit more next time instead of trying to cover the whole report, maybe spend 20 or 30 minutes on one topic. I think that would be awesome. So we'll have to have you back for that soon.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Well, listeners, tell us what you thought of this show. Go check out Dylan. Go check out The Deep Dive. Use promo code BITS to get that free month off. Check out Ansel at Ansel Lindner. Check out his writing on Bitcoin Magazine and all of his other websites. Go check me out at CK_Snarks. And yeah, 5-star reviews, stack sats, you know the drill. Peace.